Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh, South Dakota State Representative. David Lust represents District 34. He joins me now in the SDPP Black Hills Bureau. We'll talk about a little recap of the 2018 session. Thanks so much for stopping by. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Down the street.
Down the street, block away.
Yeah. You're back from Pierre. How is the how is that, you know, with the family and, you know, your regular work and just taking that time to, you know, to head to Pierre for as long as you have to do? Is it, it seems like it would be exhausting to
It's exhausting. I feel that I don't do any of the three areas of my life justice when I'm in the legislature. I'm not 100% in on the legislature. I'm not 100% in on my job, and I'm not 100% on my family. So everyone suffers a little bit. So it's good to get back to real life.
All right. So looking back on the session that was, and it's just, you know, fairly fresh in your mind still, maybe still processing, how would you characterize it? What are some of the overall successes that you think were achieved in Pierre this year?
Well, so this was my 10th session. Every session takes on a kind of a life of its own or an identity of its own. Last year, I would characterize as dominated by IM-22 and what happened with IM-22 in the legislature. This year would be initiative and referendums and liquor laws. Mm-hmm. We spent a lot of time on both those subjects, and so I think those stand out to me as things we addressed in the legislature and spent a lot of time on.
Let's talk about the liquor laws. What was at stake where all of a sudden this became such an important topic this year?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know what caused all the bills to come forth this year. I know there were some comprehensive, just general cleanup bills. And then the two topics that garnered the most attention would have been the winery bills and the craft brewery bills, probably the craft brewery more so than the wine bills. But I think good work was done in both the areas of the farm wineries and bulk wines, as well as the craft brewery area.
Can you give us an idea of what exactly has changed now, or what will change when those laws take effect?
Yeah, so on the wine side, it was more kind of an inter-industry changes and adjustments for the shipment in of grapes and juice and how it's bottled and processed versus those wines that are made with South Dakota products. So there was some percentages involved and I'm not going to get into the weeds on it, but just more clarification of what is a craft or what is a farm winery and what's not and how they label and those type things. On the beer side, I think there was really good work done there. Prior to this session, a craft brewery could not self-distribute at all. And was limited to producing only 5,000 barrels. So that limit was increased from 5,000 to 30,000, and now craft breweries can self-distribute up to 1,500 barrels, which if you're a craft brewery and there's a restaurant immediately next door under existing law, these laws don't take effect until July 1, but under existing law, that craft brewery would have to go through a distributor to get a keg to that restaurant next door. Now the craft breweries will have the ability to self-distribute, you know, up to $1,500, take a keg over there on their own, or use a distributor in an existing system. So I think that's good for the craft brewery industry, and the distributors, I think, will still be able to provide a valuable service to those businesses.
In your district, do you have craft breweries who were impacted? Is that a...
That's a really good question. Yeah. Right on the border of Lost Cabin is either in my district or real close. Other than that, there aren't any in my district. I represent the west, southwest side of Rapid City, and there aren't any craft breweries there at this point.
Right. So did you have sampling sessions to find? No, I'm kidding.
I did my market research.
Everybody did their
market
research.
I'll just put it that way.
How about overall some disappointments or legislation that you thought, that, you know, problems that needed to be addressed and legislation that just didn't carry the day that you really kind of thought had traction? What got left behind?
Well, you know, the funding issue, as we talked about before the show today, you know, you always would like to do more for the community service providers, education, and state employees. So that, you know, that's always the biggest disappointment, is you're knowing there's a glaring need there and not being able to address it. Hand in glove with that is our failure to look at sales tax exemptions. There was some bills this year to create a task force to look into sales tax exemptions and whether or not we should remove some of those exemptions or reduce some of those exemptions. And unfortunately, that didn't get much traction. And I'm hopeful future legislators and future governors will really take a look at that, because I think that's relatively low-hanging fruit as far as a revenue source goes.
What are the challenges of that? That those individual groups will lobby and say, you're raising my taxes? Is that kind of what happens?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So anytime you were going to target a specific exemption, that the beneficiary of that exemption is going to marshal all their resources and come in and say, you know, and justify why that exemption exists. And there, and in many cases, there are very good justifications. But if you step back and look at the larger revenue picture in our state, we'll need to do more to find other revenue sources. And that to me is really a pretty simple solution in many respects. But hard battles, because every special interest group will come in and say, you know, we need this because, and they'll have a good story to tell. And right. it's just a question of weighing that story and considering in the broader picture.
When I talked to Governor Dennis Dugard at the beginning of the session, he mentioned that. And then he mentioned also that you could take five away and there would be, you know, seven new ones. That every year, so, you know, individual lawmakers bring their own exemption to the table with a good story. And some. So this is after 10 sessions, ongoing thing to see more coming up as well.
Yeah, it's been interesting, because the last few sessions I've been to, there have been fewer requests for exemptions. But if you go back 60, 70 years, you know, an exemption here, an exemption there, over a course of 70, 80 years, you then have quite a few exemptions.
Right.
And each one of those, when they're passed, is justifiable and wins enough support to get through. But then when you step back and look at how many we have, you think, well, wait a minute. So I think the last probably 6 years, the legislature has been much more diligent in fighting those exemptions. So there hasn't been as many. But on the flip side, there's been no removal of exemptions either. So
right. Other responsible ways or reasonable ways that you think searching for revenue for this state of South Dakota?
Well, that would be the easiest one. We don't have many revenue sources, frankly, and you know, there's always talk in the shadows of, an income tax or those type things. I don't see that getting much traction. And so I think the focus should be on those sales tax exemptions. It's over $1 billion in exemptions each year. That's plenty of revenue if you were to take even just 10% of that. And so you could do some things in that space that's politically realistic.
Mm. Online sales tax, what are those conversations like in the State House? Because out here, you know, people are excited about it, sort of seeing dollar signs in their eyes. Is that a realistic expectation that there could be an increased flow if that case does well in the Supreme Court and favors us?
Yeah, well, we've seen, a lot of the online retailers step up and voluntarily pay that tax. So that's ongoing. What I don't know, and I don't know if anyone truly knows, is to the degree that we're not collecting that tax from those who voluntarily pay it now and those who are not, mm-hmm. and those who would be subject to the law if the law we passed is upheld. And I don't think we'll know that answer until, our Attorney General argues that April 17th, I believe, and there won't be a decision on that for several months after that. But everyone's hopeful that will help, and that will be help. I don't know. I just don't know how many millions or tens of millions of dollars that will be realized if that passes.
Right. Talk a little bit about your district and anything that came through Pierre that's going to specifically, you think, have a great impact on Pennington County.
Yeah, in my district, and it's always difficult to nail things down to your specific district unless you have an industry or something in your district, which really I don't in District 34. It's primarily residential. But I think something that will be very impactful for Pennington County will be the work that was done on Marcy's Law, and to put that on the ballot. Now we'll be on the primary ballot in June to modify what was done last year. And I know Pennington County has invested a significant amount of resources in personnel to address Marcy's Law when it passed. And if we can get those reforms passed in the primary, along with the bills we passed, the laws we made regarding Marcy's Law and victims' rights, I think that'll be a significant savings for Pennington County.
What do voters need to understand about that, about Marcy's Law and the changes, the potential changes that lawmakers want to make? Because this is, it becomes an issue of optics as well, of, you know, voters passed something, you want to change it once again. There was fallout from initiated Measure 22. But how do people need to think about this in your opinion?
Well, and rightfully you bring up those points that, you know, the legislature, I think in many respects is not handled, did not handle IM-22 properly. Marcy's Law is a different story. I think that was handled very well. The speaker took the lead, worked with the Marcy's Law proponents, worked with victims' rights groups to come with a resolution that is very beneficial to everybody. Unfortunately, Marcy's Law, as it was passed in South Dakota, just contained too many uncertainties regarding who, you know, what the definition of victim, how broad it was, the amount of crimes, the level of crimes that victims had to be informed, of a whole host of things that was just not well crafted. I think the Marcy's Law people nationally have learned their lesson in South Dakota and have modified their efforts in other states, and now have come back to South Dakota and really, to their credit, have been flexible in working with the victim rights group, working with law enforcement to get a product and a law that is much more workable and effective, frankly, for everybody. So there will be no opposition to these changes in Marcy's Law. It'll be only proponents, and I hope the public takes that away from the process, that it's a good result. A little bit cumbersome how we got there, but in the end of the day, it's a good result.
So we talked a little bit at the beginning of the conversation about the changes to the initiated referendum process in general. And I'm wondering what we're, you know, Lee Sturbinger is going to bring us a report with some of the details, but your takeaways of that and what came out of the session and the impact that it might have on voters and on citizen democracy.
Well, the first one is the process. You know, we put together a task force last session that met primarily made up of primarily non-legislators, or at least significantly non-legislators, to look at our initiative and referendum process and come with modifications. And they did that, and they did a great job. They met all summer and in the fall. It was led by a political science professor from Augustana. And had lots of stakeholders, and they had good, and there were more modest tweaks there, but for one, which is the changing of the voting requirement to change the Constitution, moved it from 50% to 55%. I think that's a very good move. You know, the Constitution, I think, should be a tougher burden to get a change to the Constitution. And I think raising it that 5 percentage points, I would frankly have liked to seen 60%.
It's a compromise, for sure.
Yeah, 55 was a compromise, and that was, I think, almost unanimously recommended by that task force this summer. So that, I think, will be significant to protect our Constitution a little bit more, because, you know, the reality is once something's in the Constitution, it is really difficult to get it out. So we need to be very deliberate and cautious when we're changing the state constitution.
You mentioned the folks that supported Marcy's Law sort of learning, and that's been one of the criticisms is that South Dakota becomes an experiment, an affordable experiment for people. Is this an example of that, but yet a success story? Or, you know, how do you see it from the big picture?
I think it is a success story, and you know, the speaker and I had an ongoing public and private dialogue about out-of-state money and restricting out-of-state money for ballot measures, and I think Marcy's Law is a good example of how it can be done properly and would not have need to involve a lot of money because there was significant concern, as reflected by the vote on Marcy's Law, for victims' rights. But that was done in a heavy-handed way. And again, to their credit, they came back and we fixed it. So I think the process works, out of state money or not. It's worked well. And I think you'll hopefully see more of that. People will learn from that and be collaborative rather than, you know, one-sided.
We've spoken with South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley about the legislative goals, his legislative goals this session, which, if memory serves me, all were forwarded on and were successful for him. Talk a little bit about just increasing, you know, penalties for drug distribution, and how did you look at some of those conversations about opioids and meth in the state in the light of, you know, challenges with prison population and addiction and really not having treatment centers that we should? It's a big conversation. How did you engage with that?
Well, I voted for the Attorney General's bills and his measures to increase penalties for distribution. And frankly, I was on a conference committee just this time last week, wrestling with the last one. And I think you said it exactly right. And I was very strong in my comments in committee that, you know, this isn't going to solve a problem. Increasing the penalties for distribution is a correct step. It's a prudent step, but it's not going to solve a problem. And the bigger problem is the level of addiction we see from meth and opioids and other substances. The lack of treatment is the biggest issue. I mean, just throwing someone in jail, you know, maybe makes us feel safer. It's not helping anybody, especially if it's just a user or an addict. And that's where I think we're missing a significant component, and that is having those treatment facilities. I mean, the stories about what meth does to the brain, are fascinating, and there's all sorts of research on how long it takes someone to truly come back from a meth addiction, and we just don't have a lot of resources targeted toward that treatment component.
Why not address treatment first, then, legislatively?
Well, and that's, you know, that there the issue is resources, right? I mean, if we had unlimited resources, you would see wonderful treatment facilities on every corner.
Right, but aren't we investing in something though? We're investing in prisons in some ways. You could argue that. Why not invest in treatment centers first?
Well, I think the medium step has been investing in different courts, the drug courts, the veterans courts, those type things. That's been kind of the let's dip our toe in the pool, see if they're, because that essentially is treatment, right? I mean, it's supervised. It's heavily supervised. Zero tolerance type situation with a treatment component. So I think that's been kind of the middle ground. Let's do this through our judicial system, see if that works. And it has worked. But, you know, the line to get into those programs is so long. But I'm with you. I think treatment should be a primary focus going forward because you're not helping anybody by just warehousing people.
This summer, any summer studies, anything looking ahead and how does that process work, sort of deciding if committees need to meet over the summer?
So yeah, that'll unfold over the next couple of months. Individual legislators and committees will submit their suggested summer study topics. The executive board of the legislature then will cull that list down to a meaningful amount and then submit it back to the legislators to prioritize what legislators want to see as far as summer studies. And then from that, you know, 2-3 summer studies will be formed, and they'll get going probably in May or June, meet through October maybe.
Any topics you see rising to the top there? Anything you'd like to participate in or see happen?
I think you'll see something in that the mental health arena as a drug treatment arena. That's something that you may see. I'd love to see something on the sales tax exemptions. We've been down that path several times. And frankly, summer studies are educational and informative, but often not resulting in significant legislation. That's just how it kind of plays out, has historically. So I'd rather have us do something on exemptions more along the lines of a task force than a summer study, but we'll see how it plays out.
Any final thoughts about the session or what's next for you as you sort of unwind and recover?
Yeah.
The work goes on, of course.
Back to my day job, and I'm excited to do that. But I'm excited to have served this last 2 years for Dan Dryden and the unfortunate circumstances that brought me back to Peer. And I'm happy I was able to do that for him and for the state, and I'm ready to move on to other things.
State Representative David Lust. It represents District 34. Thank you so much for being here today. We appreciate it.
You bet. My pleasure.